Sir David Thorne, Reel 13.
Tactics and fight. The Russians need to be taken in context of Crimea. What I've learned historically anyway, and at Cranwell, of course, the Russians were great producers of tanks. And so in Nabokovitz and other tank writers, the T-34 tank featured very strongly. The capacity of the Russians to endure their inevitable approach to warfare, which was not unakin to that of the Americans, which is that when you have mass, you tend to use it in a less flexible way than the small armies, because smaller armies have to, in a sense, dance faster around the ring just to survive and gain their impact from applying force very rapidly at critical points. And the training and instruction that we got on the Russian army at company level was fairly basic. And it was only because I'd done some work before on the sort of philosophical and organisational side about the Russian army in relation to armour and the use of armoured forces that I was able, in a sense, to be a little bit ahead of the game. And I think anyway at that stage, the British Army had some distance to go in getting the correct perspective about the Russians. On the one hand, there was the perspective of mass, overwhelming strength, and the necessity, therefore, to have tactical nuclear weapons to bring them to a halt. And on the other hand, there was the view that they were conscript army, that they lacked our finesse, and so on, which I think is right. And it was only when I became a brigade commander, not a divisional commander, and had learned a considerable amount more and spent time with those that were thinking through the Soviet Studies Group, for instance, at Sandhurst. I spent a lot of time with Chris Donnelly before I became a divisional commander, and during that time, and read quite a lot more, that I think I began to get a much better feel for a Russian that was 5'6" tall rather than 10 foot tall, and that you could analyse down where his strengths lay and where his weaknesses patently were. You can disguise your logistics problems by having tanks that run very well for considerable distances on limited fuel. But it's your ammunition resupply, it's your the maintenance task, and here of course the Russian tanks were designed to go rather like the Kalashnikov rifle through almost anything and still keep going, that you still can't overcome the fact they had enormous logistics problems. And these were not really fully understood when I was a company commander. I hadn't done that analysis myself. And I don't think these analyses had been done rigorously enough and passed down sufficiently to all ranks. And in a sense, we were living slightly in isolation from reality. There was a figure of the great big bear, and there was a perception that also they were pretty thick, that they were pretty literal and so on. Yes, I think they were, and would always be rather like blunt. The American army frequently is, because it's a mass force.
A clumsy giant.
Clumsy giant, exactly. Mm. And we'll get there by force.
Was there any sort of idea about how likely it was the Russians were to use their force? Did you have any sort of an analysis?
No, we did not get sort of intelligence assessments. What we did get was much more a generalized view, were relationships on a cool but balanced basis or were things unsettled. And in 1965 to 67, we've been through the very difficult period in the 1950s when the Russians were definitely unsettled by Berlin and those other things, and the pressure on through Berlin. And there was a kind of cold status quo. And I don't think we saw it as anything other than that. And this extraordinary border, which was the dividing line between communism and the democratic West.
You mentioned that you actually saw Russian soldiers on the border.
Mm.
Did they tend to reinforce or weaken the impression you had of them from your other sources? Just the sight of them moving about and...
The impression I got was pretty smart, pretty disciplined.
Mm.
People, I didn't see lots of them with fags in their mouths and things like that. They seemed pretty alert, but then they were a showpiece on the border.
Mm.
And so in a sense it was a bit of a false picture. By the time I did see them was... I think I mentioned it the last time when I went to Berlin to the cricket, and I described to you, I think, what was an eye-opener to me was that beneath all the showpiece discipline and so on, there was a very human creature there, pretty warm-blooded and probably with a pretty dry, perhaps pretty cynical sense of humour, which was the Russian private soldier. And this was, when I went to the Vandenberg Gate and came back via the T-34 tank, which had been sealed up there by the Russians, and which they always guarded as a war memorial. And this Russian soldier, when I, in civilian clothes, waved to him, and he knew I was a senior British officer. And I went, so I did this sort of a circular wave with a hand. Out from his greatcoat came his hand, and he did a circular wave back to me. Well, you can't do much better than get an indication that that's a pretty human, a pretty cracking response, I thought, from a Russian private soldier to a British general. And because that's when I was a general, by the way, so that was not really coming.
It was later on.
But I thought, what a cracking response. And they went up in my estimation immediately. And all I've heard since from other people is that their senior officers are a pretty hard-drinking, pretty straightforward bunch, who would be recognisable as soldiers in the British Army.
Mm. The Russian infantry always had a reputation for being extraordinarily athletic and very brave in action.
No reason to doubt that, no proof of it. But I suppose what I saw, both then and as a company commander, and also when I went to Berlin, was people who, if properly led, would be excellent soldiers. And I think the problem with the Russians at the moment is, in a sense, they are so short of money, so short of equipment, decent barracks, decent circumstances, that the morale of their army has been heavily undermined.
Well, no army benefits from political uncertainty.
Yeah, that's right. But in those days, of course, they had political uncertainty.
Mm.
And they had a considerable status.
You were saying that it was really like a cold status quo, but your tour with the Mechanized Battalion went on until 1967, and at that time, trouble was beginning to bubble up in Czechoslovakia and a certain amount of perturbation in Poland.
Mm.
Were you aware of that at the time?
Oh, yes. That was toward the tail end. And any sign like that in an army that is sitting on its backside, sitting waiting for something to happen and training for it, we would always look at the worst case situation. In a kind of sort of, so we were prepared. And I think those Nazi actions, it was an exciting situation, but I don't think we ever felt at that stage, up to the end of '67, that they were going to come pouring over the border. What we did think is that they would be handling the checks, which of course they duly did.
Did you see anything of other NATO armies while you were?
Yep. I'm sorry, I didn't have things to come into that. Saw the Germans.
What did you make of them? This is what, 10 years? 10 years after the foundation, isn't it, really? Or refoundation?
Tendency to go in straight lines. Very quick to obey orders. To what extent they were all in a, what was basically a national service army, they were enamored of the principles of Rommel at the grassroots level. I'm not so sure. They were, in many ways, I think, considered themselves more disciplined than we, because we were sort of a more regular force living there at a length of time. And there were quite a lot of signs that there were people within the British Army there who were there for life, were making it as good a life as possible, which is pretty understandable. And among them were officers who I think would have been removed pretty damn smartly at the sniff of action, because they'd been there too long and they were just not engaged with making people ready for action. They're engaged with peacetime operation of making their life as comfortable as possible for their families and themselves while fulfilling their duty as was necessary.
Garrison duty. Garrison mentality.
Yeah, it was a very, very very, very difficult environment for leaders really to keep up standards. At the same time, of course, we were just heading into a situation when Northern Ireland occurred and the British infantry were put under an enormous strain. In something that was very, very difficult and totally different from mechanized warfare.
But of course, that didn't happen until after you'd moved on, was it? Did it? And so you were really.
The residue of that.
Yes.
And it's worth mentioning it now, because I'll come back to it later when I was division commander and effective infantry. Of this almost inevitable attitude within the cavalry that they ran the army of warfare, and the infantry were way behind and simply didn't move fast enough. And the infantry's view is that the real world, where action was actually happening, where shots were being fired, where people were losing their lives, was everywhere other than Germany. And so it led to I'm quite sure within the cavalry and the armed corps to a very mistaken arrogance about, you know, the fact that they led the ban on all of this, which was probably true in many cases, but eventually so got under the nose of the infantry that by the time I became director of infantry, we took an enormous grip of that, and there's no way that the cavalry in any position now to think they do anything other than their partners in the army of warfare game. And that, you know, you look at who's been divisional commanders of the armored divisions in Germany in the last 10 years, and I would bet my bottom dollar that there's two infantrymen for every cavalryman in there. And those infantrymen are very articulate on the whole subject of the philosophy of armed warfare and an understanding of how the interplay of all the equipments and skills is the only way in which you can pursue armed warfare. And I think from the infantry, a powerful dose of realism.
Where did the artillery stand in this?
In that
matter,
debate.
Yes. Where are they directing their fire?
I think they were not directing their fire. against the infantry, because they were quite involved in Northern Ireland. So were the Army Corps, of course, but not to a lesser extent. I think what they wanted to see is a general uplifting of the quality of our performance in Germany, which did happen, and which happened thanks to people like General Bagwell.
Well, the artillery seem to have been developing their own role by paying more attention to such things as the development of self-propelled guns and their role, don't they, at that time? I think they were...
Yeah, I don't know enough about that.
Thinking in a creative way about...
I mean, I think you'd be right there. But it was much more parochial than the broad requirement. It was within their own sphere. They were properly forward-looking. Absolutely. I think the infantry did suffer from saying, look, the real war's over there. And treating Germany as almost as a rest place. That then boomeranged on them with this excessive reaction of, you know, the cavalry, and you've got to sort out the infantry and so on. Which then in its turn led to the infantry setting themselves up in a way, which has meant that ever since we've had an approach to armed warfare, which is probably, as a whole organisation, the whole corps, certainly in the last 10 years, has probably been more forward-looking than anybody. And certainly the match of anything the cavalry can produce.
Did you have good notice of what your next appointment was going to be when you were, as you were coming to the end of...
I left the Joint JCSC, went to the JCSC first for 6 months, and so had about 2 months' notice.
Yes. What did you do at JCSC?
Tried to become a well-trained tri-service officer, and made a lot of good contacts, and people who I've sort of met since, and also I think further established my confidence that I could have enjoyable conversations with everybody at every level. But I would say it didn't stick in my mind as an earth-shattering course. It was good value.
Do you remember what was on it? Do you remember what the content was? Does anything remain stuck in the mind about...
Well, one or two tri-service problem-solving exercises were good value. And it required analysis and strategic plan and so on and so forth. They were good value. And the rest, it was writing, it was becoming informed in worldwide fashion in terms of the real politics that was going on at that time. And it was listening to very well-informed speakers. And then it was sort of sitting down these courses, you know, they followed a pretty similar pattern. And the value I got out of it was that it just was a sort of mind-boggling exercise.
Well, you'd already had a considerable amount of contact with the Air Force, and you've mentioned how that provided you with a lifelong network of contacts.
Absolutely.
And it
maybe not in the same way, because the people in the Navy who came that course didn't actually, none of them sort of took off in the Navy. May say something about the Navy selection process. They never thought it was a very important course. I have a suspicion that's so. But they put people on it who were going to be sort of good middle piece, senior staff officers and so on and so forth. I'm not sure they're absolute stars.
What did you make of the Navy, you know, compared to the Air Force and the Army? Because this would have been your first close encounter with them. Their mentality and outlook and way of doing things.
I find I'm very comfortable with them. But quite prepared to walk alone, quite very independent. You know, Nelson and the Blind Eye, that tradition, very strong. And that's what I found all the way through there, since they're very confident in themselves. And by service wise, they only really switched on heavily to the amphibious assault and so on and so forth. They were very good at that sort of thing in terms of discussing the implications and so on and so forth. But again, because their top interest was submarines and where they were going, and that's one of the great sort of sources of advance for naval officers at that time, I suspect now. And naval warfare. And so I think it's quite important they did come on the course. Because, not too many years later they went to the Falklands. Something which was right into what the JCSE discussed, philosophized upon, and so on.
So you had 2 months' notice. Were you surprised by your appointment to Defence Intelligence?
I was probably, when I got it, I was a bit disappointed, because intelligence wasn't seen as a great, in those days, a great sort of area for advance.
What had you been hoping for? Had you had any expectations?
On the ops side. Oh. But I then realised, after being there about 6 months, how utterly mistaken I was, because the most important areas in peace are strategic plans and the intelligence that provides the indications of what one should be doing. Strategic intelligence. And this country has produced some of the best analysts in strategic intelligence work anywhere in the Western world. And there are some real old gurus in there, I went in there, for instance, I was involved in China. I knew nothing about China. It was an enormous education to me. It was very refreshing. Because I was pretty keen and interested, very quickly got into intelligence work and they accepted me. I then went and started linking up with both Hong Kong and particularly with the Central Intelligence Agency and the Defence Intelligence Agency, and began to realise how much our input was respected. As long as we operated, as long as we could interpret, I could interpret better, just as a lay infantryman, I felt. And I think they felt, the CIA certainly used to ask me to go along to see them. Now they wouldn't have done that if I'd been a waste of time. So I met some of the very senior people at the CIA. I think Patton's son was then one of the senior guys. He was dealing with China, probably. Americans at the time. And I remember meeting him and having a very good discussion with him. And we were then looking at the way that Russian armies, the Chinese armies, developing, and to what extent certain indications in the Chinese army, to what extent they were significant or not. And I always find a tendency in every organization, tendency to write down the opposition and not look at the practical things that are happening. And that's true, I think, in part of other intelligence organizations than our own. You need a strong dose of realism if you're going to be a good analyst. And then an excellent knowledge. And you've got to be inquisitive. Now, these are all obvious remarks, but I got great pleasure from learning about PLA and found myself, talking, because it was always an issue, because Mao was in the last years, always questioning, is Mao going to die? And I'd be asked, as a G2 and DI2 as it was, questions like that, as well as questions about
Was DI2 then the Far Eastern?
Yeah.
And you... you
so you've got Vietnam, and then the yes. was yes. China, but it was Vietnam that was heavily linked.
Mm.
Vietnam, Cambodia, and I can't remember where else, but basically I was the China, China man on the PLA and indices, but we had an excellent long-term analyst called John Bailey, who was a former Queen's officer, who'd been there since I don't know when, and one of the great authorities, and again, the Americans recognized this and so on. So he was wheeled out. Whenever anything unusual happened, John, you'd always consult John. It was one of the best examples of how you need, you know, like a good egg troop goes slow, good intelligence officer in depth, probably need to be doing that most of his life.
Continuity.
Yeah, continuity and understanding of the significance of the events and dates, and, you know, weather conditions. And if you weren't experienced in China, you'd be wondering why aircraft would be shifting in large numbers from one part of the country to another at a certain time of the year. And you look at the weather and you find that it was a time of monsoon and things. And they were probably carting food and stuff urgently. Just as, you know, the Korean army at a certain time of the year, you know, would be out picking acorns.
On harvest leave,
yeah.
Yes.
Mm. And unless you recognise those realities, you're just going to make fools of yourself time and again.
Now, when you joined 68, this was the time when the PLA High Command were closing down the Cultural Revolution and there were major ructions going on.
Mm.
Do you remember drawing any conclusions about that, about whether the army as such was likely to be successful in subduing and controlling the Red Guard, or whether the radicals might be able to break loose again?
Our view was always that the PLA would get the better of the Red Guard ultimately. PLA were the absolute bedrock of the security of the country, that which caused it to have stability, that which could be ordered to solve crises. The Red Guard, no. The Red Guard could create exciting political movements and flows, but could not produce the mass effect that the PLA could when it turned its mind to whatever was required, political or military.
But, I mean, at the time, I think some of the PLA elements, the General Rear Services Department and the General Political Department, they had been infiltrated by radical elements and were hand in glove, weren't they, some of the extremists.
Now, of course, I'm going back a long way, but certainly our view was that to what extent there was infiltration, there were also extremely powerful forces who were not infiltrated, and the moment it would have become dangerous, then, you know, okay, it never became that dangerous. Like that. It was okay, infiltration, yes, and you get this in every army, of course. The PLA is a very strong political force, governed by, ruled by the Central Committee and by the commissars, but with very strong basic military traditions. The Red Guard was a Mao phenomenon, and he was losing his. I mean, he was a very old man.
He seems to have lost his political judgment when he started the Red Guard off, because he certainly never managed to retain control of them.
Absolutely. That's probably the short reason why he lost control of them, but had enormous status internationally in this country. That the Red Guard were ultimately going to fail. Because in the end, he did call the shots right to the end, as each one of them, these sort of patriarchal figures, has done. Okay, there's a sort of caucus round each of these, which in the end decides when they're truly dead.
When the old man has to go.
Exactly. Mm. But that caucus would have been very fearful of